In the excitement about targeted molecular therapy, it's worth remembering that both bevacizumab and trastuzumab are used with chemotherapy, and paclitaxel has been particularly successful in combination with these targeted agents, as noted by Dr. Sledge, perhaps because of an anti-angiogenic effect of this taxane. Nanoparticle albumin-bound paclitaxel, or nab-paclitaxel, has been the subject of a number of interesting clinical studies, and I met with Dr. Bill Gradishar to discuss the results of a study he first presented in December 2006 at San Antonio, and then again with more analyses at ASCO in June. Dr. Gradishar discussed the background of this trial.
Nab-paclitaxel was developed to really take advantage of the significant anti-tumor activity of the taxanes, and also try and avoid some of the side effects. So the nab-paclitaxel is based on a platform where solvents that are typically used with drugs like docetaxel or cremophore-based paclitaxel are absent. And instead, the paclitaxel is basically using a albumin delivery system. So the drug, in a sense, is using that platform to increase the amount of drug that actually gets to the tumor tissue, which has been demonstrated preclinically. That's the underlying rationale for the development of the drug, and what's been shown to date, both through some of the early phase 1-2 trials and then ultimately the phase 3 trial, is that nab-paclitaxel given every 3 weeks was superior to solvent-based paclitaxel given every 3 weeks. And the other findings that came from that study, just as a way of background, were that despite giving more of the nab-paclitaxel, or even more specifically, more of the paclitaxel within the nab preparation than was administered with every 3 week solvent-based paclitaxel, there was less neutropenia. There appeared to be a different kind of neuropathy that resolved quicker, and there was also a greater anti-tumor effect in terms of response rate and improvement in progression-free survival. But really what most people wanted to know about practicing clinicians was, in an era when we're using more weekly therapy, and also in an era when many perceive docetaxel to be the most active anti-cancer therapy drug as a single agent for breast cancer, how did nab-paclitaxel compare, either with a weekly schedule or the question of how does it compare to docetaxel? So with that sort of as the premise, there was a randomized phase 2 trial that was conducted that we reported in San Antonio last December, subsequently updated at ASCO this year. And basically the design of the trial was looking at patients with metastatic breast cancer who were receiving therapy as first-line treatment. And patients were randomized either to receive an every 3 week schedule of nab-paclitaxel given at 300 milligrams per meter squared, or docetaxel at 100 milligrams per meter squared every 3 weeks. And the other two treatment arms were weekly schedules of nab-paclitaxel administered weekly 3 out of 4 weeks, either at a dose of 100 or 150 milligrams per meter squared. And what the trial demonstrated was that the weekly schedules were more active from the standpoint of anti-tumor activity than either every 3 week docetaxel or every 3 week nab-paclitaxel. Those were the findings reported in December. And the other piece of the equation, of course, were side effects. And what was generally appreciated from that experience was that the weekly treatment arms were not only very active, but very well tolerated, particularly the 100 milligram per meter squared weekly 3 out of 4, as at that time appearing to be sort of the optimal schedule. And, you know, to further hone down on that, when you looked at the weekly schedule with 150 milligrams per meter squared, had a slightly higher response rate, but it also was associated with slightly more toxicity. And in December, there didn't seem to be much of a difference in terms of progression-free survival between those two treatment arms. Now, with longer follow-up and the planned fourth interim analysis, it's actually emerging that perhaps the 150 milligram per meter squared weekly schedule may be optimal, not only from the standpoint of high anti-tumor activity, but also it appears to have the best progression-free survival of the four treatment groups.
Can you talk a little bit more about the efficacy numbers in the different arms?
in December, when the first presentation was made of the randomized trial, we found that the weekly treatment arms were associated with response rates in the 60%+ range. And that compared to the every 3-week treatment arms of either nab-paclitaxel or docetaxel was markedly higher. The caveat with the December presentation was when the trial was first designed, it was really designed with the intention of getting some hints as to what might be the optimal treatment approach using nab-paclitaxel that would ultimately define the kind of pivotal phase 3 trial that would follow. And what wasn't included in the initial trial design was an independent radiology review. That was subsequently added, and since December, and what was part of the ASCO presentation just a month ago or so, was the findings from the independent radiology review as it related to response rate. And what's often observed is when you include an independent radiology review in any trial, you'll find that the response rates typically are less than what the clinicians report. And part of that is obviously because the radiologists are blinded and not directly involved in the trial. They don't know what the index lesions are, et cetera. So it's very common that there's a drop-off in the response rate. That was also identified in this trial as well. So whereas in December, where we were reporting investigator response rates and the weekly schedules were markedly superior to every 3-week nab-paclitaxel or docetaxel, with the independent radiology review, there was a drop-off in the response rates across all 4 treatment arms. However, the weekly schedules remained superior to either every 3-week nab, paclitaxel, or docetaxel. I think it dropped down into the 30% range for both weekly schedules. But again, they both remained higher than every 3-week docetaxel, every 3-week nab, paclitaxel.
What about progression-free survival? What was seen there?
Whereas in December, we would have said that the progression-free survival was, not really all that different between the nab-paclitaxel treatment arms, but all superior to docetaxel given every 3 weeks. What's emerging now with the ASCO presentation from 2007 is that the every 3-week nab-paclitaxel and the weekly schedule of 150 milligrams per meter squared nab-paclitaxel arm appear to be the superior treatment arms, and the one that really emerges probably not only from a standpoint of efficacy but tolerability as the treatment arm that's probably going to be pursued in a pivotal trial is 150 milligrams per meter squared. I think there's a caveat to that, though. I think it's important for the design of a pivotal trial, a randomized trial that'll be fairly enormous in size, probably 1,000 patients or so, to identify the treatment arm that clearly seems to be associated with the best progression-free survival. From a pragmatic standpoint, there have been several different experiences with weekly schedules at doses ranging from 100, 125, and even 150. And we certainly know that 100 and 125 are very well tolerated. 150 is very effective, as I already mentioned, but you probably do pick up a bit more toxicity. And I think one of the things that'll come out of the randomized trial that's been designed and is anticipated to start in the fourth quarter this year is whether or not the added anti-tumor efficacy that's presumed to be associated with the weekly schedule will offset perhaps what might be slightly more toxicity than we might see with lower dose weekly schedules of nab-paclitaxel.
What about safety and side effects, and particularly neuropathy and resolution of neuropathy in the study?
Yeah, with the latter point first, that is neuropathy, one of the interesting observations made across all the trials is the notion that the neuropathy might be different. I think one of the first things that people would have considered is that with nab-paclitaxel, you get rid of the cremophore, there's no neuropathy. And what has been observed in every trial, even from the phase 1 trials, is you dial up the dose to very high doses, you are going to get neuropathy even in the absence of cremophore, and that might be obviously attributable to the chemotherapy drug itself. And whether you're looking at Q3 weekly schedules in the randomized phase 3 trial, or you're looking at neuropathy and Joanne Blum's U.S. Oncology experience, or even the experience that we've reported from the randomized phase 2 trial, there is a rate of neuropathy that occurs with nab-paclitaxel, but there seems to be a fairly consistent finding. Admittedly, the numbers are not huge in each of these experiences, but where there's resolution of the neuropathy to the point where you can readminister the chemotherapy drug within about 3 weeks. So in other words, you get a decreased diminution in the neuropathy or the severity of the neuropathy to the point where you feel comfortable readministering the drug. Now, that's in contrast to what we typically see when patients develop grade 3 neuropathy with solvent-based paclitaxel, where the duration of the neuropathy is generally much longer lived. In fact, the package insert alludes to a somewhat ill-defined period of neuropathy that can occur with Taxol. But I think there is something to it. I think it needs to be studied to a greater degree. And obviously, whenever you have these sorts of analyses from large trials, a lot of it depends on physician reporting, patient reporting, trying to elicit the symptoms from the patients. And it's not always completely objective, but rather more subjective, not only in the part of patient reporting, but physician asking the patients. All that said, my feeling is, and I think the consistent observation, is neuropathy does appear to be different with nab-paclitaxel. In terms of other side effects, what's been generally observed either with every 3 week schedules or weekly schedules is the degree and frequency of significant neutropenia is decreased. There's very little febrile neutropenia that's been associated with nab-paclitaxel at the doses that have been evaluated. In contrast to docetaxel, stomatitis is clearly less whether you're using every 3 week or weekly schedules. In general, the neuropathy, if you look at the randomized phase 2 trial, there is not a huge difference in neuropathy rates across the different treatment arms, but what has been observed in the randomized phase 2 is that within the nab-paclitaxel treatment groups, probably the weekly schedule of 100 was associated with the least amount of neuropathy. And then as you go through the other side effects, there's nothing that really leaps out. So I think the sort of gestalt consistent finding across all trials is that nab-paclitaxel is pretty well tolerated, and there aren't any unusual side effects that one would anticipate associated with that sort of novel platform of an albumin-based preparation of paclitaxel.
Now, I've heard people not, I wouldn't say be skeptical, but question. I mean, you yourself are saying that, you know, in terms of how fast the neuropathy resolves, that it's something that's kind of in the not proven type stage. But can you talk a little bit more about what you specifically saw with regard to that issue, resolution and neuropathy, in this recently reported study with the different weekly and Q3-week regimen?
And again, most patients don't have grade 3 neuropathy, so when we talk about the observation across any of the trials with nab-paclitaxel, we're talking about relatively small numbers of patients, either in individual trials or collectively across the trials. But what the consistent observation has been by different investigators, whether it's the pivotal trial that I presented or whether it's the data that Joanne Blum and Joyce O'Shaughnessy generated from U.S. Oncology, is that when the grade 3 neuropathy develops and you consider rechallenging the patient with the drug, you want to wait until the neuropathy is resolved to a point where you feel that the patient will tolerate it. And generally, you get a decrease, not resolution. I think it's important to make clear that we're not talking about resolution of neuropathy because, number one, in some of these trials, patients came onto the trial with some level of neuropathy. It might have been only grade 1 neuropathy. So when we talk about patient experiences, grade 3 neuropathy, you're not going to put them back on the drug until they resolve to grade 1. We're clearly not saying, nor is anybody else saying, that you get complete resolution of neuropathy. But there is what appears to be, across trials, a faster resolution to a level where you feel comfortable going forward with the drug, which is in contrast to what has been observed with solvent-based, cremophore-based paclitaxel. Now, I think you pointed the simple fact out that, you know, this hasn't been studied in a rigorous way where you have a neurologist doing some sort of specialized testing where every single patient is rigorously evaluated and questioned. Obviously, the patients in all of these trials were seen in a variety of places, settings, investigators, different countries, and the observations are the result of looking at the reporting that comes from the individual toxicity data from each of these patients. So it's not a rigorous trial looking simply at neuropathy, but it's sort of a subset analysis that has come out of all of the data generated to date.
Now, you talked about the phase 3 trial that's coming up. What exactly are the randomization and eligibility going to be?
The randomized trial is going to evaluate patients with metastatic breast cancer receiving therapy with either docetaxel given every 3 weeks at 100 per meter squared or nab-paclitaxel with a weekly schedule at 150 milligrams per meter squared. And we would have said, 6 or 8 months ago that the nab-paclitaxel treatment arm was going to be 100 per meter squared. But then as more events came out of the randomized phase 2 trial, as the data matured, as we had more information, updated data on progression-free survival, we elected to use 150 milligrams per meter squared. I should add as well that one of the questions that people often ask is, okay, you compared nab-paclitaxel to every 3 week paclitaxel. We don't really use every 3 week solvent-based paclitaxel anymore, so is that really a relevant question, in 2007? In the randomized phase 2, you looked at weekly schedules of nab-paclitaxel compared to docetaxel, but what hasn't been addressed is how do you compare nab-paclitaxel to weekly schedules of solvent-based paclitaxel. And there is a CLGB study that is going to address that question where weekly schedules of solvent-based paclitaxel are compared to nab-paclitaxel. And then actually a third arm is building on the data that Linda Vedat presented looking at ixabepalone, which of course is not a taxane per se, but an apothalone. But all three arms are looking at weekly schedules of something that works at the microtubule level.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the other issues related to this. Now, first of all, what about bevacizumab? Now, this trial you're talking about, is that going to include bevacizumab?
No, it's not going to include bevacizumab, but there are experiences that have combined nab-paclitaxel with bevacizumab, and I think what we can say at this point is that it's feasible. There aren't unexpected side effects other than probably economic. And there'll be more interest in looking at that combination going forward.
What about the use of NAB plus bevacizumab in a non-protocol setting?
Well, we have combined nab-paclitaxel with bevacizumab, and I think one of the issues, of course, is as we see patients with newly diagnosed metastatic breast cancer, where we're trying to identify the optimal treatment approach, we are acutely aware of E2100, which looked at weekly solvent-based paclitaxel with or without bevacizumab, and that's sort of what the FDA is looking at, too, in an effort to hopefully ultimately get bevacizumab approved for breast cancer. But what that trial demonstrated, as we know, is there was enhanced response rate, better progression-free survival, and it sort of naturally leads to the question of whether it be an advantage to, as opposed to using solvent-based paclitaxel in that combination, use nab-paclitaxel. And I think the simple answer is yes, because there is this sense that perhaps nab-paclitaxel would be better tolerated than solvent-based paclitaxel over time, with the added benefit that you don't have to give steroids and the associated side effects, etc. We won't formally know the answer to that until the CLGB study is done, not with the question of bevacizumab added in, but rather how does it compare to weekly Taxol versus ixabepalone. But, we have given Abraxane with bevacizumab to patients. I think there is an economic issue with that, but it's a reasonable consideration. The drugs are active and they're well tolerated.
What about the issue of NAB plus capecitabine? I always thought that the trials that you did, one, and Joanne Blum did another one looking at Cremafor paclitaxel for capecitabine, showed some pretty interesting results, particularly compared to docetaxel capecitabine that had been reported earlier. And I know a lot of clinicians in practice had used capecitabine and paclitaxel when they wanted to use combination therapy. What about NAB and capecitabine?
Well, I think any place where there is potentially a T, whether it's docetaxel or paclitaxel, people have either tried or formally evaluated in phase 2 trials at a minimum the combination of Abraxane, wherever that T was. And I think the experiences reported to date, it sounds somewhat generic, but the combinations, whatever they might be, XT, GT, substituting it becomes GA or XA, there's response rates that are at least what you would expect with the alternative taxane. And the tolerability issue, I think, is what there's at least a suggestion that from these phase two trials that the side effect profile might be more favorable. You know, whether or not that's actually true, one needs to objectively measure that randomized trial, somehow directly comparing the taxane or nab-paclitaxel preparation. But to date, there's feasibility with any of those combinations. It's been done. I think it's well tolerated, and I think it may be better tolerated than what you might expect with the alternative solvent-based taxane.
You mentioned the issue of lack of need for pre-medication. How much of a benefit do you think that is to patients? How much problems do you think they run into, particularly because of the steroids?
I think it's particularly germane for patients who are on therapy, hopefully, fortunately, if they are, for an extended period of time where you have to continue to re-expose them to steroids, whether it's, you know, relatively infrequent or whether it's low dose. Regardless, steroids, as we all know, can affect people's quality of life. I think as you get into older patients, the contribution of steroids to, in a sense, screwing up perhaps other comorbidities, including diabetes, et cetera, may increase. So I think the steroid issue, when you look at the whole package, I think the steroid issue is relevant, and I think it does contribute to some of the problems patients live with. And, you know, specifically I'm talking about things like agitation, anxiety, having difficulty sleeping, as well as glucose intolerance, et cetera, but things that day-to-day can affect people. Some people aren't eager to gain weight, and if they're on taxanes that require steroid premedication over a prolonged period of time, which is obviously the hope if they're benefiting from the therapy, then you're going to have a sort of cumulative effect potentially of those steroids. So I think being able to avoid that is a plus.
Now, we do patterns of care studies, and we did a recent one with both ONCs in practice in the United States as well as U.S.-based clinical investigators. And one of the things that came out was kind of surprising was we asked them, do you use steroids and premedications with different taxanes? And when it came to nab-paclitaxel, although the investigators, virtually none of them used premedications, with the docs in practice, about 30% were using premedications. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's an important observation. I remember talking about this with you in the group, and I think that it basically represents perhaps a misunderstanding or an opportunity for greater education. I think there maybe is this perception that it's a taxane, therefore you still run the risk of anaphylaxis or perhaps subtler forms of hypersensitivity. But to date, that hasn't been the case, and I think that you sort of defeat one of the goals of using a NAB preparation, and that is the ability to avoid giving steroids. So whether it's the nurses sort of on autopilot giving anybody that has some form of a taxane going in, steroids, or it's just lack of understanding of the underlying rationale for developing the drug, it's unclear. But what is clear is probably more education is necessary.
Now, would there be any rationale to use corticosteroids for anti-emesis?
Well, again, I suppose if there was a companion drug that was associated with emesis or a emetogenic potential, then perhaps you might elect to use a steroid, although there might be alternatives. But nab-paclitaxel by itself, nausea and vomiting is a pretty uncommon complaint.
And also, I guess, in the trials, the steroids weren't used.
Steroids weren't used. And, you know, if you look critically at the phase 3 report comparing Q3 weekly solvent-based paclitaxel to every 3 week nab-paclitaxel, there were a small fraction of patients who received nab-paclitaxel that received steroids. It was a few percentage. But those were patients who were receiving it for some other medical disorder, not as an anti-emesis compound.
What about the issue of NAB in the adjuvant setting? There have been now some pilot studies looking at dose-dense AC NAB. Can you talk about what those showed and also where you see NAB heading in terms of adjuvant therapy?
There have been experiences that have looked at AC fall by nab-paclitaxel. demonstrating that you can give it in a dose-dense fashion, that you can administer the Q3 weekly dose on a two-week schedule. So feasibility has been demonstrated. I think the thing absent from what we know is how it compares directly to other regularly used regimens. Be you a fan of TAC, docetaxel adriamycin cytoxin, or dose-dense AC fall by T, where the T is paclitaxel. I have no personal belief that you're going to find some huge surprise substituting nab-paclitaxel for any position that paclitaxel holds in the adjuvant setting from the standpoint of somehow compromising efficacy. In fact, you know, there is the possibility that by being able to administer it at a higher dose safely, and in essence being able to give more of the taxane safely, that perhaps you would have greater efficacy. Of course, the only way of really addressing that is an enormous randomized trial. And we went to the FDA at one point with the data that had been generated from the clinical experience to date. It was sort of, in a sense, a swing for the fences effort to use that data to get an adjuvant approval. And the panel was fairly dismissive of the notion in the absence of a randomized clinical trial. But of course, the problem with a randomized clinical trial is the size of the trial, be it non-inferiority or superiority type trial. You're talking about thousands of patients. And in today's era, when we're trying to look at newer agents, novel approaches to treating breast cancer, I'm not sure that anybody is going to have the willpower or the resources to really do a trial that requires that many patients for that kind of question. So it's sort of a dilemma. Now, the other question could be, would you use or consider using nab-paclitaxel in the adjuvant setting as a substitute for solvent-based paclitaxel? The answer is yes. Have we done it? We have done it in some patients. Those have generally been the relatively rare patients where they're sensitive to the effects of either steroids or they've had some sort of hypersensitivity reaction, and then we substitute nab-paclitaxel. But from reasoning what we know in the metastatic disease setting, I have absolutely no reason to think nab-paclitaxel would not be a good substitute for Taxol in the adjuvant setting.
Let's shift over to some other issues in chemotherapy metastatic disease. And I want to get your thoughts on George Sledge's presentation at ASCO of the Excalibur study looking at bevacizumab and capecitabine. Of course, you were a co-author on that study. What were your thoughts about that data set?
The Excalibur trial was a trial that, in a sense, tried to revisit the issue of combining capecitabine with bevacizumab. There had been an earlier experience comparing capecitabine to capecitabine plus bevacizumab in patients who had gotten prior therapy for metastatic disease. That prior experience didn't really demonstrate that there was a significant added advantage for bevacizumab to capecitabine in a setting where patients had gotten prior treatment for metastatic disease. There was really no incremental improvement in progression-free survival. Response rate did go up, and there were no red flags in terms of side effects. They were sort of the typical expected side effects related to bevacizumab, being hypertension and proteinuria, as well as the capecitabine side effects. Obviously, E2100 followed that suggested that if you use bevacizumab earlier in the time course of treating metastatic disease, that there was indeed an advantage both in terms of response rate as well as progression-free survival, although we don't yet see a survival advantage for the combination. So the whole issue of revisiting whether you could combine capecitabine with bevacizumab in a sense became interesting again, because there wouldn't be necessarily a reason you wouldn't think that bevacizumab couldn't potentiate the effect of capecitabine if used earlier. In other words, there conceivably could be that same effect with a number of different chemotherapy drugs. So the Excalibur trial was designed to look at the use of capecitabine as a first-line treatment for metastatic disease, a typical capecitabine schedule. And what it demonstrated in a phase 2 trial, not randomized phase 2, but a single-arm phase 2 trial, was that you did modestly, incrementally improve the response rate over what one might expect. There weren't significant added side effects when you combine those two drugs over capecitabine alone. And perhaps most interesting is, although there wasn't for the entire population treated, dramatic improvements in clinical endpoints if you compare them to historical controls. When you broke down the groups into those that were either ER negative or ER positive, there was sort of the striking observation that there was a much higher response rate, a significantly longer time to disease progression in the ER positive population. And all the speculation in the world hasn't really resulted in a satisfying answer for why this might be the case, but it is what it is, and I think it's probably, you know, something that requires further thought. But in that population, there clearly seemed to be a marked improvement over what you would see with ER-negative patients with the same combination.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting to look at those, because first when you say that, you think, well, you know, you're breaking the, I guess that was unplanned subset analysis.
That's right.
But then when you look at those curves, I mean, they were pretty impressive.
Right. There were fairly dramatic differences between the two groups. And, you know, one can speculate, and a lot of people have, there's no preclinical data supporting it yet, but how ER and the VEGF pathways interact, could there be something to this? The observations are what they are, and I think, you know, there'll probably be additional information that comes from this trial because there was blood and other translational components to the trial that will hopefully be reported at San Antonio in December.
And I guess, you know, we've gotten really into the issue of chemotherapy and ER status in the adjuvant setting, but I'm not sure how much I remember seeing about ER and chemotherapy in the metastatic setting and also related to Bev. Has that been reported before?
No, that hasn't been broken down from E2100 to the best of my knowledge. And, you know, whether that will be done, my guess is now with this observation, it would certainly be something that one would want to do to see if there's any consistent finding across the trials about an ER positive versus an ER negative patient population. And E2100 lends itself to that very nicely because obviously it's a randomized trial.
What about the issue of practical decision making? Capecitabine obviously is an agent that people, you know, have top of mind, particularly in patients who've had taxanes in the past. What about the use of Bev plus capecitabine? And do you think that this ER at this point is something that should be considered in that decision?
No. You know, the observation made from the Excalibur trial that George presented, I think, is very interesting. And it's not, despite that fairly striking difference, we're still talking about a subset analysis. We're still talking about a clear explanation for why this would be the case, and perhaps other trials that don't show that difference. So I would not personally use this as a decision tool for how I would approach patients.
Can you talk a little bit about how you are making the decision in terms of first-line chemotherapy, particularly in patients who've had taxanes in the past in the adjuvant setting?
In patients with metastatic disease, you know, we have a sort of a broad menu of options, which is a good thing. Part of the decision-making about what comes first is what came last and how long ago was it, meaning the adjuvant therapy. So the fact that a patient had a taxane in the past wouldn't preclude me giving it to them again. I think it may not be necessarily my first choice if they were the kind of patient that developed progressive disease very rapidly, you know, within a very short period of time.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the research that you're involved with, specifically at Northwestern. You're looking at satraplatin, was that correct?
That's right.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about satraplatin in general and specifically in breast cancer?
Yeah. So satraplatin is an oral platinum drug, and the platinums were sort of abandoned many years ago because they were initially evaluated in breast cancer in patients who had been very heavily pretreated. And the response rates were generally in single digits from many of those experiences. The platinums sort of became interesting again for a couple of reasons. One is there was some suggestion that there would be synergy with, quote-unquote, newer drugs like the taxanes, and a number of trials have explored their use in that setting. And there's, you know, finding particularly with Taxol that that may indeed be the case. And then once trastuzumab entered the picture, there was a body of evidence suggesting that certain combinations of drugs may be synergistic with that particular targeted agent, including the platinums and the taxanes. So suddenly the platinums became interesting again. And then there's even emerging information that in patients with triple negative disease, that perhaps, and I underline the perhaps part because we don't have a lot of data, that the platinums may be a particularly good agent to build on in that population of patients. So there's a renewed interest in platinums, and as a result, you know, there are compounds in development, including satraplatin, which is oral, which doesn't have a lot of single-agent activity for breast cancer, but where we're looking at it and just about completing, I hope, the trial with capecitabine, which is attractive because obviously you're combining two oral agents, and we're just about wrapping up that trial at this point. It was a phase 1-2 trial in patients with metastatic disease. I'm not sure that we'll be able to tell anyone at the end of that trial what the expected response rate would be in a less heavily pretreated patient population, but we're starting to get a sense of the toxicities as we go through the data. And the Europeans are also running a similar trial with the same combination. So I think we'll both be completing at about the same time. These are two independent trials, and we'll be able to look at the data that comes from that. But it may be, perhaps, an attractive new agent that could be utilized in lieu of IV platinums.
And I guess at this point, nothing alarming has been seen in terms of side effects or toxicity.
That's right. And again, I think it should be pointed out that nothing totally unexpected. And again, these are patients who've been heavily pretreated, so they start perhaps with some baseline lower threshold of developing toxicities, but there have been no untoward effects that one wouldn't have expected.
Now, another trial at Northwestern I thought was kind of interesting was in the pilot neoadjuvant study looking at Abraxane plus lapatinib. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that trial is being done and accruing at this point. Again, it's difficult to make any or draw any conclusions from the experience to date because there are still many patients that need to be accrued to that trial. We've seen some very good responses, including one PATHCR using that combination. Patients, as you might predict, have to be HER2 positive to participate in that trial. And we're not seeing any side effects that we wouldn't expect with that combination. I think as a follow-up, we're also doing a study that, again, is a phase 1-2 trial of, in this case, Doxil plus lapatinib. And that's for patients with metastatic disease. And where there's interest in that trial is not the expectation that we're going to see some dramatic improvement in response rate because these are heavily treated patients, but rather it's an opportunity to look at the combination of an anthracycline with an anti-HER2 agent. And we reported, you know, very preliminary data at ASCO this year. Mary Sinfroca in our group did that. And again, we're not seeing any significant cardiac toxicity, but that's based on a relatively small sample size.
Now, what's been seen to this point in terms of lapatinib in the neoadjuvant setting?
Well, I think if the patient population is selected well, that you're seeing an effect that's not surprising if you were to contrast that with what you might expect with trastuzumab in the same setting. The issue about tolerance, it's tolerated. I think where people are combining it are probably, again, with taxanes preferentially as opposed to anthracyclines, but it's combinable, it's tolerable, and there have been in the correct patient population, meaning HER2 positive, based on small experiences, relatively high response rates.
Let's talk a little bit about the EFFECT trial that you reported at the San Antonio meeting in December. Can you talk about what that study looked at and what was seen?
The EFFECT trial was an effort to address the issue of what you do in patients who've received an aromatase inhibitor, specifically a non-steroidal aromatase inhibitor, either as treatment in the adjuvant setting and then develop progressive disease, or with use of an aromatase inhibitor in the metastatic disease setting. And there's been no shortage of discussion, not a different discussion that we often have with chemotherapy. What's the best sequence? Is there an optimal sequence with endocrine therapy? And with smaller pilot experiences, we've known that you could treat with a different subclass of aromatase inhibitor, in other words, going from a non-steroidal to a steroidal, drugs like anastrozole going to exemestane, or vice versa, and that there would be some fraction of patients that get a response. There were also smaller pilot experiences that would suggest that you could go from a non-steroidal to a drug like fulvestrant, a selective estrogen receptor downregulator, and get a response as well. And the EFFECT trial was an effort to try to rigorously address this issue in patients with metastatic disease who had received a nonsteroidal aromatase inhibitor who were randomized to either receive fulvestrant plus an exemestane placebo or exemestane plus fulvestrant placebo. The other question that was being addressed by this trial, at least an effort to get some insight into it, was whether or not utilizing a loading dose of fulvestrant might accomplish or get to a higher steady state level more rapidly. And there had been preclinical experiments done long ago that suggested the FDA-approved dose was probably just on the threshold of where you were getting anti-tumor activity. But one of the limitations, in a sense, of being able to administer fulvestrant is the need to give it as an IM shot in the buttock. And because it's very viscous and the volume is an issue, the question was, could you get more in and get to steady state levels more quickly? So in the EFFECT trial, patients were actually given 500 milligrams on day one, so basically a shot in each cheek, and then day 14 and 28, 250, and then monthly thereafter. And modeling experiments would have suggested that if you use a higher dose early, you get to the steady state levels quicker. A corollary of that is if you don't get there, might you be taking patients off trial prematurely because they're simply not getting the effect of the drug rapidly enough? Pharmacokinetics were done in this trial and actually demonstrated that you could very much mirror what the modeling predicted. In terms of the efficacy from the trial, it's interesting because there's never been a trial I've been involved in where just about every endpoint was superimposable on the other treatment arm. So whether you look at response rate, whether you look at time to disease progression, whether you even look at tolerability, adverse events, patients who received either fulvestrant or exemestane had identical outcomes in all of those categories. So I think the conclusion that was reached is that, you know, one could approach a patient who had received a nonsteroidal aromatase inhibitor legitimately with either one of these agents, and it's not absolutely clear that you have a superior sequence that you must follow. Either one of those drugs would be acceptable after a nonsteroidal.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the research directions with fulvestrant, where you think things are heading. And I guess one issue that is the issue of combining with an aromatase inhibitor. We have the SWOG study that looks at anastrozole versus anastrozole fulvestrant. We have the SOFIA study, which looks at the continuation of an AI plus fulvestrant versus fulvestrant alone. Where do you think things are heading in terms of that strategy in postmenopausal women?
With regards to fulvestrant going forward, I think there's continued interest in exploring whether the dose does make a difference. And I suggest in the EFFECT trial that the loading dose strategy maybe made a difference in some patients. There are even efforts to look at even continuing that, in a sense, double dose beyond that point to try and look at even somewhat higher doses within that early time period. And we don't have the results of those trials at this point. In terms of combinations, you know, going back historically, if one looks at old data, looking at progestins and tamoxifen or other combinations, we weren't exactly impressed with the outcome of combination therapy with respect to enhancing response rate, but we did see that there was added toxicity. I think we sort of abandoned that strategy for a while, but now I think we're coming back to it because the drugs we have are more selective, or I should say at least there's an interest in re-exploring that. So among the trials you talked about, the strategies that are being looked at is, in a sense, either receptor blockage as well as, in a sense, getting rid of the ligand. So that gets to the issue of an aromatase inhibitor, which would eliminate the estrogen or drive it down, and then a drug like fulvestrant, which, in a sense, eliminates the receptor, sort of total estrogen blockade, in a sense, not just the ligand, but the receptor. And there are also trials that are designed that patients who are on anastrozole who progress would simply have fulvestrant added with the anastrozole to continue. And I think, you know, those trials are of interest. We don't have any data yet with those trials, but I think they may make us revisit this whole idea of whether combination therapy in select postmenopausal patients might be enhanced with that kind of using unique drugs with unique mechanisms of action. There's been a great deal of discussion, and I've been engaged in some of those discussions over the last 2 or 3 years, if not longer, about would fulvestrant find a home in the adjuvant setting. And, you know, it still remains an issue that isn't resolved. There's no commitment that I'm fully aware of to launch a major adjuvant trial. Again, the same issues, large numbers of patients isn't necessarily the most relevant clinical issue. But one of the considerations with adjuvant fulvestrant, with or without other therapy, is how long would you consider IM shots? There are advantages, of course, to utilizing a shot form of therapy that can be given perhaps only monthly, because we know from numerous different studies that compliance issues are real in patients getting aromatase inhibitor therapy or tamoxifen therapy, that as you go year to year, the number of patients who actually remain compliant diminishes. So might it be a strategy to use something that could be given as a shot once a month, be a better strategy resulting in better outcome? Don't know. The other issue is how long would women be willing to accept a shot given monthly? Would they go beyond a year? Would they go beyond 6 months? It's hard to know. Again, in the metastatic disease setting, since patients will progress, the duration of therapy in most of those patients was relatively brief. So I think we don't know the answer, but there is a legitimate rationale for considering fulvestrant in the adjuvant setting.
Now, what about fulvestrant in premenopausal women? There are a lot of people who just, you know, make patients postmenopausal with an LHRH agonist and or oophorectomy and then just use the postmenopausal algorithm and patients end up getting fulvestrant. But what about the use of fulvestrant in people who are actually premenopausal hormonally? I know there's been some interest in looking at higher dose. Mike Dixon reported some things on that. Where are we with that?
Again, I think the limitation is data. One can construct or frame a situation where it might be a reasonable thing to do, and I'm sure I've probably done it somewhere, and given that treatment to a woman that was rendered postmenopausal by therapy with a luteinizing hormone release, you know, LHRH agonist type drug. We don't have any data in any significant body of patients, number of patients who've received fulvestrant as treatment for their metastatic disease. I think if you knew definitively a woman was postmenopausal hormonally, then it's not an unreasonable thing to consider using fulvestrant. Part of the issue with using fulvestrant in a premenopausal woman, forget about rendering her postmenopausal, is whether or not you can really, you know, overwhelm the system because there's so much sort of estrogen around, et cetera. Would fulvestrant really be an effective agent in that setting because you may have so much ligand, meaning the estrogen, that it competes very successfully with the amount of fulvestrant that you can get in. So if you could decrease the amount of naturally occurring ligand, that is the estrogen, maybe the competitive advantage would be gone and fulvestrant would be able to work well. Again, that's speculation, but you know that would be the rationale for considering it if you ablated or suppressed the ovaries.
What about fulvestrant in the patient who has an ER-positive, HER2-positive tumor? There's been a lot of interest in that subset to start with, and there's been interest in both fulvestrant plus trastuzumab as well as, actually, there's a CALGB trial looking at fulvestrant and lapatinib. What about those strategies?
I think they're very rational because, you know, we always look at these presentations at our meetings and we're struck by the less than simplistic overlapping pathways that we now appreciate within the cell. It used to be that we would think about the estrogen receptor having this very linear sequential effect. You hit the estrogen receptor with ligand and very straight line effect right down to causing the cell to divide and et cetera. I think we now appreciate, it sounds somewhat generic to say, but it's a whole lot more complicated than that. And in particular, we know that the HER2 pathway and the ER pathway do affect one another. And it may be a very reasonable strategy to come at the pathways with two different agents, be it a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which would be a small molecule acting intracellularly, or an antibody like trastuzumab in those patients who are ER positive. And if you use fulvestrant, sort of eliminating the receptor, perhaps it's been demonstrated preclinically that you can have an additive effect. It may translate into greater benefit clinically in patients.
Any other research that you're involved with that we haven't talked about that you might want to comment on?
I'm the PI for a large trial that compares, it's a direct mimic of E2100. It's weekly solvent-based paclitaxel with or without sorafenib. And, you know, the goal, again, is to look at other targeted agents. In the case of sorafenib, obviously attractive being oral, that perhaps, you know, affecting the VEGF pathway, that you could achieve similar effects, perhaps different tolerability issues, but also be able to use an oral agent. So we're doing that.
Is that in the first-line setting?
First-line setting. It's a direct, every aspect of it looks like E2100.
But there's no bevacizumab in it.
No, I'm talking about the trial design.
Oh, yeah, no, I understand. But I'm just saying that you're going to have to find patients who don't need to be, this is first-line?
Correct. So the trial will be done probably both in the U.S. and out of the country, and it'll be probably threatened. I mean, it's open now. It's accruing patients, but it'll be threatened a little bit once bevacizumab assumedly gets approved. You know, a lot of those patients would get bevacizumab. So there will be an effort to accrue patients outside the country as well, just because we recognize that at some point, whether it's 6 months from now or 9 months from now, patients who are getting first-line paclitaxel will probably get bevacizumab with it.